From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Potrero Hill.
Glen Park.
South Beach.
I live in Bernal Heights.
Coming up, we'll discuss the aftermath of last night's fire at the Chevron refinery in Richmond.
People in the area are reporting that they weren't notified until they saw the fire on the news. And they didn't realize that there were health concerns coming their way until they saw it on television.
Then we'll hear about a bill that could change California's immigration policy.
Before, I would have never questioned calling the police if I needed help. Now I need to think really hard about whether I would do that again.
And we'll explore the mysterious hidden villa.
Well, Cesar Chavez actually came out and did organizing here. He organized the first farmworker strike and used Hidden Villa as a place, a safe haven, to do some of that organizing.
We're under the radar today on Cross Currents. Stay tuned. Last night's fire at the Chevron refinery in Richmond had city residents in a state of panic. The fire sent up a huge plume of black smoke, stopping traffic, closing bridges, and shutting down BART stations. The large-scale chemical fire still has local residents concerned for their health and safety. Many say they heard about the fire late and that the multilingual phone system that's supposed to alert the diverse communities of Richmond in case of disaster didn't work. Roger Kim is executive director of the Asian Pacific Environmental Network.
After another major fire at the Chevron refinery in the early 90s, our community members, Laotian refugees who we organize in the city of Richmond, advocated for a multilingual warning system. Unfortunately, that warning system didn't work yesterday, according to the members that we've talked to. They have a system in their home, and yet they did not receive a phone call in language as they were supposed to, so we're investigating why the system failed.
And while it's all over now, Richmond Mayor Gail McLaughlin says she wants a full investigation into what happened and how another fire can be prevented. As more information comes out, many are wondering what systems Chevron has in place to do that.
Every refinery is required by its regulators to have what's called an emergency management plan.
That's reporter Sean Maher of the Contra Costa Times, who's covering the fire and its aftermath. We called him up earlier today.
This is what they call a controlled burn. The primary fire itself was put out last night, but the leak itself doesn't appear to have been totally fixed. We don't know the details of what still isn't fixed, but we do know that there is still a small amount of hydrocarbon leaking. It's kind of like a diesel vapor. And this is a common thing that fire departments do, where they, if they have a gas leak that they can't control, they will leave the flame burning so that the gas doesn't build up and create the potential for fan explosion.
Okay, so what exactly was burning last night? Was this oil? Was this gas? What was burning?
This was a vapor of something called hydrocarbon. It's a byproduct of diesel production that is similar to diesel itself, that began leaking at around 4:15 in a specific unit of this very, very large refinery. The leak continued for about 2 hours while people in the refinery were examining it and trying to figure out what was wrong and what to do about it. And then at about 6:30, Chevron's telling us the volume of the leak increased dramatically enough that they evacuated the building, and shortly after that, the hydrocarbon ignited and caused that huge flame everybody was seeing.
Right, and lots of people are talking about the health impacts of this fire throughout the area, and I'm wondering what numbers you're hearing as to how many people actually showed up in the hospitals and how many people have been harmed or have come out with being harmed.
Well, we know that area hospitals have reported at least 350 patients coming to see them, reporting respiratory problems or vomiting. Most were seen and then sent home. And those numbers are crawling up a little bit. We're seeing, I'd say, close to the neighborhood of 400 at this point. The Bay Area Air Quality Management District has done testing in several cities in the area. The smoke went up something like 4,000 feet, and much of it didn't actually come down in Richmond itself. There were reports of odors and of smoke being found in Martinez, in Solano County, and even in Oakland. Regulators have gone out and taken air samples as recently as 1 a.m. today, and preliminary results are coming back that they're not at unusual levels, that folks aren't in a lot of danger at this point, if you weren't feeling sick last night, you're unlikely to feel sick today.
Right. Unusual. They're not unusual levels of, I quote, sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxide, hydrogen oxide, sulfuric acid, and nitrogen dioxide. It still sounds scary. What are people talking to you about there, about what their fears are?
Well, the mayor of Richmond in particular is raising this issue a lot. You know, there's particularly in the East Bay and in parts of it that deal with a lot of production of you know, diesel fumes and so forth. You get a lot of this around the port as well, and in West Oakland. There are huge respiratory problems that are more systemic than is often easily identifiable. So the mayor of Richmond, Gail McLaughlin, is calling on Chevron to be as transparent as possible in the process. She's calling on a full health investigation. And then she's also raising concerns that we've been hearing a lot about. The biggest thing that we're hearing people upset about so far is that they didn't find out quickly enough. That people in the area think that many of them are reporting that they weren't notified until they saw the fire on the news. And they didn't realize that there were health concerns coming their way until they saw it on television.
That was Sean Maher, reporter with the Contra Costa Times. And we'd like to hear what your concerns are. Call us at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. You can also voice those concerns tonight at 6 p.m. at a community meeting that Chevron is hosting at the Richmond Memorial Auditorium, located at 403 Civic Center Plaza in Richmond. All that information is also at KALW.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. It's been a busy season for immigration issues. In June, President Obama announced that he would halt the deportations of undocumented immigrants who came to the U.S. as minors.
These young people are going to make extraordinary contributions and are already making contributions to our society.
A week and a half later, the Supreme Court struck down most of Arizona's controversial immigration law, SB 1070. Meanwhile, in California, new legislation that some are calling the anti-Arizona bill passed in the state Senate and Assembly. In the next month, Governor Jerry Brown will decide whether to sign the Trust Act into law. The Trust Act would enable California to opt out of some of the requirements of a controversial federal immigration program called Secure Communities. The program, known as SCOM, asks local law enforcement to run the fingerprints of people they arrest through a federal immigration database. If a person is undocumented, they report him or her to federal officials. Though it's meant to focus on criminal immigrants, the government statistics suggest SCOM has affected mostly more immigrants without criminal records. Since California began the program, more than 75,000 people living in the state have been deported. Around 70% either have no criminal conviction at all or were convicted of minor crimes, like selling ice cream without a permit or running a red light. The bill was authored by San Francisco Assemblyman Tom Amiano and has support from California Catholic bishops, Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa of Los Angeles, police chiefs from both Oakland and Palo Alto, and various immigrant rights organizations, among others. And if it becomes law, it will change the way the whole state deals with illegal immigration. KALW's Mariel Waloff has our story.
En el 2010, mi esposo y yo íbamos a traer los alimentos para mi casa.
My husband and I were driving home.
This is Yvonne. It's not her real name. She asked us not to use it. She's a Mexican immigrant and doesn't speak too much English. So her lawyer, Jackie Shul Gonzalez, is translating for her.
We had gone to purchase some groceries and we were driving on Foothill Boulevard. My husband was driving and accidentally ran a red light and he was stopped by police officers.
Lamentablemente ese día mi esposo no llevaba ID.
When the police pulled him over, Yvonne's husband didn't have ID or any papers for his car. The police didn't find anything suspicious, but they still arrested him. He spent the next 2 weeks in jail and immigration custody. Eventually, Yvonne got him out on bail, but the government had already started deportation proceedings.
Mi niño va a cumplir dos años.
My son is about to be 2 years, is 2 years old now, and it's been about 2 years that we've been fighting this case.
Ivan's husband doesn't have a criminal record, but the Secure Communities Program, known as ESCOM, means that just getting pulled over was enough to bring him to the attention of immigration authorities. His history and the amount of time he's been in the U.S. means he might ultimately be allowed to stay, but it's not guaranteed.
In my country, there's no work. It's very hard to survive. Food is expensive, clothes is expensive, and I think that I would stay as long as I could.
If the Trust Act had been in place when Ivan's husband was arrested, it would have required law enforcement officials to treat him as they would any citizen and release him from jail once criminal charges were dropped. Trust Act author Tom Amiano says the shift in priorities will allow local police to focus on more pressing issues.
You know, the cop on the street, he or she knows that many times it's a waste of their time when there's other stuff that needs to be attended to, real violent crimes or harmful criminal activity, rather than wasting their time on someone who may or may not be documented.
Local law enforcement's job is keeping the public safe.
Harmeet Dhillon is the chairman of San Francisco's Republican Party and a supporter of ESCOM.
And if the federal government has mandated that keeping the public safe, and particularly in this post-9/11 era, includes keeping track of all undocumented aliens and deporting many of them, I don't think that the state is at liberty, or particularly municipalities should be at liberty, to ignore those laws.
But as more undocumented immigrants have come into contact with ESCOM, many people worry that the program is actually hurting public safety by eroding trust between citizens and the police.
You know, you have a fear factor here, a chilling effect.
Yvonne says her encounter with police in Oakland has changed the way she thinks about authorities.
Yes, it definitely changes my feelings. Before, I would have never questioned calling the police if I needed help for something. And now I need to think really hard about whether I would do that again and whether the reason I'm calling is necessary.
On a Friday evening in June, several representatives from immigrant rights organizations are facilitating a Know Your Rights workshop for residents of Turk Street family apartments in the Tenderloin. Participants flip through a pamphlet about the Trust Act. On one page are two cartoons, each showing a different scenario on the same city street. The first cartoon, titled ESCOM, shows a police car driving down an abandoned street and neighbors running in fear. The second cartoon, titled Acta de la Confianza, or the Trust Act, shows the same street bustling with activity. A man and a young girl wave to a police car as it passes. A speech bubble above their head says, Hola, Officer Perez. Cristel Gallegos organized the workshop. She says she hopes it will give immigrants more confidence in their interactions with police.
In the Tenderloin community, there's lots of drug use, there's lots of violent crimes, so a lot of our families do want to see a heavy police presence. But, you know, we're also really critical of the way that policing is done.
The Trust Act heads to Governor Brown's desk later this month. In San Francisco, I'm Marielle Walloff for Cross Currents.
Share your thoughts on immigration at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106, and we might get you on the air. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. And now we'll meet a couple that took a very different approach to immigration and to foreign citizens than what the government favors today. In 1924, Frank and Josephine Duvenick saw a valley they liked in Los Altos Hills and bought it. The wealthy Palo Alto couple then built and ran what would become the oldest operating hostel in the country. During World War II, the Duvenicks opened their doors to refugees from home and abroad. And after the war, they started a multicultural summer camp for kids that continues running to this day. It's called Hidden Villa and includes an environmental education program and a working farm. In this piece from our archives, reporter Audrey Dilling talks to some of the original campers.
Mark Seidel and Elizabeth Bowden-Smith are leading me and some former campers on a tour of the grounds. We're walking through a meadow that looks like it could have inspired the setting of Bambi, if not for the herd of kids.
So I think it's appropriate that we start our little walking history tour here at the sort of opening of the valley, the wonderful hidden villa.
Eager campers dart around a patch of dewy grass, awaiting instruction from their outnumbered counselors.
Okay, so do you guys see?
Jean Geis is also on the tour today. She says not much has changed about the land since she participated in the first summer camp here in 1946. The smell has definitely stayed the same.
It's amazing, and I walk other places, and I smell it, and then I think, Duvenix, Hidden Villa.
Geis's fond memories of the place actually begin before her first camp session, when she came to live with the Duvenix under some special circumstances. In 1942, when the U.S. ordered everyone with Japanese heritage to leave the West Coast, Geis's family had to leave too. She and her mother moved to an internment camp in Utah. Her father volunteered to go fight the war.
And believe it or not, there was a lot of conflict in the camp because my father volunteered. And there were people who were unhappy about that. So you can imagine the strife in camp. People were angry. People were confused. But my mother said, we're American citizens. We are loyal.
In 1944, just as people were being let out of the camps, Geis's mother saw something in the local newspaper. Josephine Duvenek had posted an invitation to live and work at Hidden Villa to ease the transition back to normal life.
So Mom decided to go to the Duveneks, accepted her invitation against the recommendation of many dear friends and her mother-in-law, saying that, you know, you might be shot.
Geis and her mother boarded a late-night train back to the Bay Area. Geis was six, and she had no idea what was waiting for her at the end of the ride.
This is our mother and daughter duo, Cleopatra and Maisie.
They said hello.
And they produce wonderfully rich milk. And
Hidden Villa was pretty much the exact opposite of where Geis and her mother had been living.
You've got to realize, in camp, we had no eggs. Everything was powdered. Powdered milk, powdered eggs. So when we came here and had that rich cream, could you imagine, after being in a dusty desert behind barbed wire, to come to a place like this where there were eggs from chickens?
Our tour swings by a cozy, dim barn that's home to some new chicks. Across from their pen is a larger coop with some layer boxes built into the walls.
It's just a wonderful experience to be able to open this up and take out a warm egg and pass it around, have the kids hold out their hands, and they can feel the warm egg and see right where it came from. Their eyes get really wide and they get quiet and careful. It's pretty great to see.
Today, Hidden Villa sells the eggs at a local farmer's market along with their organic produce. They use the farm as a learning tool for campers and participants in an environmental education program that goes on during the school year. But in Geis's day, farm work was for the adults. She spent her time here climbing trees, riding horses, and sometimes doing chores. In her memoir, Josephine Duvenek wrote that Geis blossomed at Hidden Villa. And Geis agrees.
That was her observation. I went from this very withdrawn child to a very positive person, which I think I still am today.
Michael Hamilton also came to Hidden Villa in the late 40s. Though he hadn't met Geis before today, the two share some common memories. They recall a man named Julius Wall, who came to Hidden Villa after escaping the Nazis. And Hamilton was around for another significant visitor, Cesar Chavez.
I think I saw him once. I don't remember meeting him. I may have shaken his hand, but I don't, you know. Much more interested in horses.
Chavez's presence is still remembered at Hidden Villa. Walking up a tree-lined path, we come across a counselor carrying proof.
Oh, look, one of our baby goats. Have we named them?
This is Cesar.
Is that after Cesar Chavez?
I think so. But we have Cesar and we have Harvey.
Well, Cesar Chavez actually came out and did organizing here. He organized the first farmworker strike and used Hidden Villa as a place, a safe haven, to do some of that organizing.
Oh, that's awesome.
So maybe that's why we called this goat Cesar.
Hidden Villa's rich history informs the mission it strives for today, to teach respect for others and the natural world. Seidel says it's the same thing the Duveneks were going for back in their day.
You know, the mission that the Duveneks had and they started were based on some of the same problems that we have today. It's not like the problems have changed. We still have a lot of people that don't respect each other. We have conflict based on lack of understanding, lack of appreciation, lack of respect, and we have natural resources dwindling. And so those were problems then. Those are problems now. Some of them may be greater, some of them may be a little bit less, but those are always problems that we're going to be tackling. Yeah.
And until those problems go away, Hidden Villa will be here, taking them on one camper at a time. From Los Altos Hills, I'm Audrey Dilling for Cross Currents.
Have you been to Hidden Villa? We want to hear from you. Post your memories and your photos on our Facebook page. We are KALW News. And now it's time for your stories. This is San Francisco StoryCorps. Your culture may often dictate things like what you eat and how you talk, and bringing together cultures like the Hidden Villa Camp does can be an enriching experience. But at one time in the U.S., your culture also determined who you could and couldn't marry. That is, until 1967, when the landmark Supreme Court case Loving v. Virginia made the U.S. a better place for many people in love. It declared unconstitutional the 1924 Racial Integrity Act, which prohibited marriage across racial boundaries. If not for Loving v. Virginia, Robin Raber Luna would not have been able to marry her Filipino husband and then have their daughter, Rachel Luna Hemmer. Daughter Luna took her mom, Hemmer, to the StoryCorps booth in San Francisco and asked her how she met her husband.
It didn't really cross my mind that there was ever an issue until we got serious. And the issue was not mine. The issue was my parents. They grew up in the Depression. My mom grew up in the Bronx. My dad grew up in Poland for the first 3 years, and then Canada. And you know, they grew up in a situation where they themselves were discriminated against as Jews. So I think that part of it came from a very protective place. You know, but again, this is all in hindsight, not at the time you're experiencing it. But they understood what it meant to be different, but to then put yourself in a situation that makes you more different, I think made it really hard for her, my mom in particular. When they found out that Roy was Filipino, my mom in particular started saying things to me that were very hurtful about Roy's being in a different race, and that I was living the world through rose-colored glasses if I wanted to pursue that, and what was going to happen to our children if we ever had children. And I told them that his parents were very comfortable, you know, with the racial issue. And her response, well, of course they are. They are upgrading themselves. And it was after that that I chose not to talk to them any longer. So for 2 years, we didn't talk. We flew down to L.A. I did not bring Roy with me to their house at first. That was a really difficult visit because I was trying to explain to them what my relationship with Roy meant to me. And I told them that he wasn't, you know, just my partner or my lover. It was like he was my brother and he was my friend. And my mother turned, looked at my dad and said, "You're none of those." And I was floored. I think she looked at my dad more like, well, you're my husband. You're not, that's the relationship I have with you. Mm-hmm. But at the time, that's not how I took it.
Right.
But it was also very startling to think that she still obviously had a lot of anger. We had decided to get married. And so I told them that. And I told them I really wanted them to meet Roy. When they got to know him as a person, all the other issues just disappeared.
That was Robin Raber Luna. She was interviewed by her daughter, Rachel Luna Hemmer, in the StoryCorps booth at the Contemporary Jewish Museum in San Francisco. That was facilitated by Frank Kingman and edited by KALW's Isaac Silk. You can find more family members interviewing each other at KALW.org. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Buffy Almendarez, Zoe Bresny, Julie Kane, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Nina Gensler-Debs, Lupe Hernandez, Chris Hoff, RTM's Konohovs, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Nina Nicole Morente, Erica Moo, Mary Reese, and Stephen Short. Today's show is engineered by Seth Samuel. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Martina Castro is our managing editor. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. Thanks to City Car Share, they provide an alternative transportation option for our reporters. City Car Share is online at citycarshare.org. And thank you. We are listener-supported radio. Tune in to Cross Currents tomorrow at 5. We'll learn how the Oakland Police Department is trying to connect with the community.
The generation that's going to change Oakland PD is the generation who's going to live here and know what's going on here.
That's tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents.
I'm going to take this page off me.
What's that you're hearing? It's not Ray Charles, and it's not Joe Cocker. It's Tim Hockenberry. Hockenberry will soon stop performing at the Bay Area clubs where he's played for years, replacing them with only shows at auditoriums. Why the change? Well, he's now a semifinalist on America's Got Talent on NBC, but he'll be playing one last time at his old standby location, the 142 Throckmorton Theater in his hometown of Mill Valley, before the national tour. And that takes place next Sunday at 7:30 p.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.